Today, from gold mines to arms deals, why Russia is making moves in Africa, and the speech by American comedian Jon Stewart on his fight to secure healthcare for the 9/11 first responders.
So I went off to Russia thinking that the country under Vladimir Putin was a sort of semi-democracy, and quickly realized that it was actually a kind of darkening authoritarian state.
From 2007, Luke Harding was the Russia correspondent for The Guardian. But Russia wasn't particularly a fan of his work.
Wrote a series of stories that the Kremlin didn't much like. My reward was to be deported from Russia in February 2011.
Just kicked out?
I was kicked out.
Once he returned to the UK, he continued to cover Russian affairs. And recently, he was given access to a trove of leaked documents, which show Russia's extensive attempts to influence and control countries in Africa. Their aim? To turn parts of the continent into a strategic hub. This story has a lot of twists and turns and some very interesting key players. What does it, in its essence, tell us about Russia's influence?
It tells us that Russia is everywhere and nowhere simultaneously. And I think the ultimate goal is to establish or to re-establish Russia as a global power, a global player, a co-equal to the United States at a time when the Trump administration is actually kind of almost heading to the door, to the exit in international affairs, and Russia, meanwhile, is wanting to kind of own the room.
The document suggests that there is a central figure leading this push into Africa.
There's one person who's running the show, and his name is Yevgeny Prigozhin.
Once a hot dog seller, this powerful oligarch is now a close ally of Putin's.
He's a fascinating and dark character whose backstory is so wildly improbable that were you to pitch it to Netflix as a miniseries, it would be rejected on the grounds of ridiculousness.
From The Guardian, I'm India Rakesson. Today in Focus, what are Russia's plans for Africa? Has Putin always had plans in the continent?
No, he hasn't. And what's interesting is that when Putin took over, I would say he wasn't much interested. What changed fundamentally was the war in Ukraine in 2014.
Key towns have fallen, including Novoazovsk, along Ukraine's southern coast. But Kiev and Western officials say this time there is a key difference. Kremlin forces are spearheading the attack.
Led to extensive and damaging sanctions by America and the European Union against Moscow, to Putin's fury.
The EU has promised aid to Ukraine, but it's now split over how to impose potential sanctions against Russia. Eastern EU states are taking the hard line. Western members want to...
But also kind of forced a rethink of its sort of geopolitical strategy. That this push for Africa is born out of a need from the Kremlin's point of view to find new partners in the world, to find new business deals, new sources of revenue, and to somehow kind of escape or break free from sanctions. So Russia basically wants more friends at a time when it's a pariah, or you might say a sort of semi-pariah in terms of the European Union and America.
And why Africa then? Why target there?
It's partly to do with politics. Now the thing that keeps Putin awake at night is the fear that there will be what the Kremlin calls a kind of color revolution, which basically means a sort of pro-Western, pro-democracy uprising where the government is overthrown. He sees protests against him by the opposition as being instigated by America, and has complained in the past about Hillary Clinton. And really, he interprets what goes on in the world through the same prism. So if there's a anti-government revolt in Sudan, for example, he imagines that this is the CIA. He really, really doesn't like color revolutions wherever they may break out. Now, the thing about Africa is that they are approaching a bunch of incumbent presidents, most of them not democratic, and saying, look, work with us. We'll give you advice on election technology. We will sell you arms. By the way, you can give us some gold or some diamonds in exchange. And it's a sort of package. There's no interest in human rights. Putin doesn't believe in human rights. He sees them as a kind of excuse for the West to meddle in other countries' affairs. It's purely pragmatic. It's about business, but with a strong element of kind of political technology involved as well.
And obviously, like the US, France, the UK still have quite a lot of influence in the region. I mean, do they have plans for that?
Well, that's another fascinating dimension. One goal of Russia's push is to try and topple out the former colonial powers. And what's interesting as well is that this struggle is being sold to incumbent African leaders as a kind of fight against colonialism.
Okay, and all of that comes from these documents. What are they? Where have they come from?
So these documents that I've seen come from the Dossier Center, which published material in Russian on leading Kremlin personalities, people associated with Russian power, not just Putin, but others, from bankers to politicians to state-friendly oligarchs. And they have an anonymous submission platform, which means people can kind of leak them stuff. And I think they've been kind of quite effective on shining a light in dark places. What you have to understand about Russian politics is exceptionally murky. There are no press officers to call. There is planted rumor, disinformation. It's quite hard to interrogate as a kind of correspondent. So if you have real documents, which the Dossier Center shares from time to time with The Guardian and with other people as well, then it helps you to write accurate and penetrating stories.
Okay, so the Dossier Center gives you access to these documents, and they show the extent that Russia is trying to bolster its presence across Africa. And there are many of what seem to be references to one man in particular, and that's Yevgeny Prigozhin. Tell me about him.
He was, well, I guess the polite phrase is a tearaway. The less polite phrase is a criminal in his youth. He was jailed in 1981 for 12 years for theft, got out in 1990.
Was he wealthy as a child?
No, he was from an ordinary, very ordinary kind of family background. And then just as sort of capitalism was dawning, he started selling hot dogs.
Right, but then in the 90s, he sets up this incredibly successful restaurant in St. Petersburg. Quite a step from hot dogs to fancy food.
Well, he claims that he made a lot of money from hot dogs, that the dollars were kind of mounting up. That this is his version of events. But the point is, what you have to understand about St. Petersburg of the 1990s is that there were two outwardly mobile groups. One were politicians, and the other were criminals. And Prigozhin found himself a little niche in this kind of criminalized ecosystem because he served them food. And then in 2001, Putin turns up to dine at this elite restaurant, and he brings along his good friend, French President Jacques Chirac, and Prigozhin serves the food. And pretty quickly, thanks to his connection with Putin, he became extremely rich.
Right.
He had a palace in St. Petersburg, he got a helipad, he had a yacht. But also, I think it's fair to say that he saw himself as being a servant of the state being Putin.
He's been linked to various Kremlin operations, one of which is Russian interference in the US elections in 2016, which you've looked at extensively. What exactly was his role there?
He started funding this troll factory, basically commenting, sending out pro-Putin messages, not just at home in Russia, but also internationally.
And all online, all social
media. Yeah, including on The Guardian, including on our website.
And he's running these troll armies.
He's been funding it. So he's the money behind the troll army.
Right.
As a result, he was indicted by Robert Mueller for interfering in America's election of 2016. And what we now know from Mueller's indictment, which is kind of quite rich, is that this was an extensive campaign.
Yevgeny Viktorovich Prigozhin funded the conspiracy through companies known as Concord Management and Consulting, LLC, Concord Catering, and many affiliates and subsidiaries.
Involving actual Prigozhin operatives traveling to the United States with an aim of helping Donald Trump, smearing and discrediting Hillary Clinton.
President Putin, you smile, let me finish. They say that these units were specifically involved in hacking into Democratic Party computers, stealing information, and spreading it to the world to try to...
And another operation that Prigozhin has allegedly been involved with is the funding of something called the Wagner Group, a name that comes up a lot in these documents relating to Africa. Who are they?
The Wagner Group is a private military contractor. Basically, it's a bunch of mercenaries who allegedly are funded by Prigozhin and run by someone called Dmitry Utkin, whom we believe to be a former Russian military intelligence officer working for the GRU. And Wagner has been prodigiously active in recent conflicts. It has a base in southern Russia. There are leaked records which show people from Wagner traveling from this base all over the place, including to eastern Ukraine, where they fought alongside pro-Moscow separatists who are fighting against the Ukrainian government. And most recently, they've been highly active in Syria. It's become an almost mythical entity. It's all over the Russian press. Prigozhin, for what it's worth, says Wagner doesn't exist.
Last year, Prigozhin denied being linked to Wagner, his company saying, quote, "We do not have any information about this organization."
But that there's substantial evidence to show that it does exist and that it's also involved in Prigozhin's Africa operations.
And to be clear, the Wagner Group is not the state.
Well, this goes to the heart of what's going on. Formally, it's not the state. And this is what Vladimir Putin says whenever he's asked about Wagner. But of course, Prigozhin's operatives, their work is closely coordinated with the Russian Foreign Ministry and the Russian Defense Ministry, although there are sometimes rivalries as well. It's the state with a hoodie on.
So the Wagner Group is, in essence, a private army, allegedly funded by Prigozhin. And Prigozhin is also funding other work in Africa too, work with different firms that all fall under this kind of umbrella of an organisation called The Company. And we know about all of these different entities because helpfully the documents you've seen include this map here. If we look, it's a really simple looking yellow map. It shows the 13 countries coloured in red where Russia has influence or maybe just ambition at this point. And most of them happen to run down the spine of the continent. There's also Madagascar, and then there's the Comoros Islands. Tell me about this map.
Well, so it says Robota Compagnia v Africa, which means the company's work in Africa. The Prigozhin employees refer to their work as the company with a cap C. It's a kind of all-encompassing entity, which can mean mercenaries in Syria, but can also mean shadowy firms in Sudan interested in gold. Prigozhin is the head of the company. He's referred to in internal correspondence as the chef. And this map just shows what the company's been doing recently.
And it's got quite a good key up the top of sort of like little a rifle emoji.
Yeah, it's got there's a little Kalashnikov, which means military cooperation. There's a policeman, which means sort of training with security forces.
French flag.
There's a French flag, which means it says rivalry with France. This is all in Russian. Two hands shaking, which signifies cooperation.
There's little annotations across the map, and each annotation has a number coming off it. What's that for?
So there is a number between 1 and 5. It says an indicator of a level of cooperation, 1 being no cooperation and 5 being the maximum. So we have Central African Republic and Sudan and Madagascar at 5, South Africa, Libya at 4, together with Zimbabwe as well, and then other countries, lesser numbers, including South Sudan, Congo, Zambia, and so on. It's a bit like a kind of end-of-term school report. Actually, this is what we've done, and this is what we haven't done. This is where we got good grades. This is where we could kind of improve.
So let's talk about some of these countries where the cooperation is at number 5. And let's start with the Central African Republic, one of the poorest countries in the world. It's been torn apart by conflict for decades.
It's seen Muslim Seleka and Christian anti-Balaka militias pitted against each other.
Russian presence has been quite well documented there, though, hasn't it?
Well, it has, although we do learn something new from this document. It says Russia is an 83% friend. I don't quite know what that means, but that's...
How do you measure that?
I'm not sure what the metric is, but that's I'd say the closest friend, certainly the most important strategic partner. What really struck me about the Central African Republic is that this document claims that the company, Prigozhin's company, have replaced National Assembly members who are pro-French, and indeed the foreign minister, and got rid of them, basically demanded their sacking. And has been replaced by a more Russia-friendly figure. And in the Central African Republic, the National Security Advisor is actually Russian.
It's actually Russian?
Yeah. He's a Russian former intelligence officer called Zakharov.
Is that normal? Does that happen?
That's
often?
Not normal.
No.
And I think what it says also is that Russia is keen to exploit weakness. If there's a weak state racked by sectarian problems or a civil war between different kind of ethnic groups or factions, that's the kind of perfect milieu for Russia to try and make inroads. This is a classic KGB doctrine. And what the Kremlin appears to be doing in Africa is plotting for the long term.
Central African Republic has been in a civil war for years. It's very resource rich. I mean, it seems like a good opportunity, doesn't it?
it's the perfect place for Russia to use as a sort of strategic hub. First of all, Russia's sort of mission there is UN sanctioned. They've come in a peacekeeping role, so the military base is fair enough, you might say. But also, it offers opportunities. It offers opportunities in terms of mineral wealth, diamonds, uranium, gold, and so on. And dare I say it, there's also plenty of scope for corruption. It strikes me that the state now is semi-captured by Moscow, which is not to say that it doesn't enjoy some autonomy, but I think Russia is extremely well entrenched.
In July 2018, there were three Russian journalists who went to investigate the role of Russia in the country, and they were murdered. What happened to them?
This is a ghastly story. These were three journalists who were actually working for the dossier centre. They were on assignment, flew in with the goal of investigating Prigozhin and Wagner.
The crew was on the ground working on a documentary about the work of private war contractors, the group known as Wagner.
Central African Republic is a pretty lawless place. It's quite dangerous at the best of times, but they were driving towards one of these bases when they were ambushed and they were shot, executed at the side of the road. Now, the Russian government says that it's their own fault. They didn't have permission. They were victims of a robbery. But there's really very compelling evidence to show that, first of all, it wasn't a robbery because nothing was stolen. There were a sort of canisters of gas, diesel, which is very valuable, which was just left there. And there is other contentious evidence, let's say, which suggests that people around Prigozhin may have been cognizant of what was going on.
Sudan is on that map. It's also number five in terms of cooperation. And it's also seen decades of bloody civil war, followed by instability, and ruled until recently by Omar al-Bashir.
It's reported that Sudanese security forces have used live ammunition in clashes with demonstrators marching on the presidential palace in the capital, Khartoum. It's the latest in a series of anti-government protests. They're demanding the resignation of President Omar al-Bashir,
who is accused of organising war crimes and crimes against humanity by the International Criminal Court. So what's Russia been doing there?
The Sudan documents are absolutely fascinating. What we can learn from them is that last year in 2018, there was a large number of Prigozhin people who come to Sudan with a goal of basically keeping Omar al-Bashir in power. Bashir is someone who'd been to Moscow, who'd met with Putin. The Russians had invested an awful lot in him. And this mission come up with various tips, strategy documents, some of which are quite funny because they have been literally copy and pasted from what the Kremlin does at home in Russia with anti-government protesters. And in one place, the word Russia has been left in the text where it should read Sudan. Someone forgot to swivel it around.
Okay, so what sort of things are they advising them to do?
For example, Bashir is told that he needs to discredit the opposition, to portray them through state media as being pro-gay rights, as being a Zionist, smear them in all sorts of ways. Meanwhile, Omar al-Bashir should project himself as a kind of leader of the nation, someone who's above party politics, a kind of Putin figure, basically a Sudanese Putin. So that was the plan. Now, Omar al-Bashir part implemented some of this stuff, but basically he didn't. And one of the letters I've seen is a draft of a letter written from Prigozhin to Omar al-Bashir saying, you know, dear Omar, we stand with you, but we're disappointed that you haven't implemented our ideas and fear that your government is suffering from excessive caution. It's basically a reproving letter from Prigozhin to Omar al-Bashir. And of course, what happens next is that Bashir is removed by his own military in April in a coup. Pro-democracy demonstrations continue. And then over the last 10 days, we've seen awful attacks by Sudanese government forces on unarmed protesters with dozens and probably hundreds of people killed.
The high hopes for Sudan's revolution today lie battered on Khartoum's bloodied streets after the country's interim military leaders attacked a protest.
Do we get a sense then that Russia is still involved then?
It seems clear to me that Russia is so invested in Sudan that it will wish to reach an accommodation as quickly as possible with whatever new ruler, military ruler, takes over in Sudan, and that clearly it's on the side of the regime the authorities and not on the side of the protesters. That absolutely was the strategy all along.
So it's on the side now of the regime who overthrew Bashir, who they were then on the side of, who they even said, we support you, but you're misbehaving. They sort of went so far as to tell him off.
Russia's strategy in Africa is to work with incumbent power, to work with dictators, whether it's in Zimbabwe, whether it's in Sudan, whether it's in the Central African Republic and so on, is they're not interested in funding or supporting opposition groups. They're not interested in democratic forces, actively the reverse, that they want to shore up presidents and super leaders across the continent, and they want to strike down any kind of Western influence. Now partly it's about realpolitik, partly it's to do with politics. The goal is to keep African presence in power and to marginalize and drive out pernicious American influence.
Are his allies growing then?
Well, they are growing, but the question is whether his new friends in Africa and elsewhere will redeem the damage done to the Russian economy by American and European sanctions. And the short answer is no, it won't.
We propose to move to a further stage of the European response today with travel bans and asset freezes on individuals.
Sanctions infuriates Putin because it's sort of humiliating, and also infuriates him because his billionaire friends, many of whom have been sanctioned by America, are moaning all the time that they can no longer go and enjoy their yacht and float around Corsica in the summer, or access their wine collection in Switzerland, or visit their mistress in London. So Russia, Putin, Prigozhin are trying to find creative solutions to expand influence in a deniable way. And in Africa, I think they're making some progress. But the other thing to be clear is that it would be wrong to suggest that the Kremlin, Prigozhin, are pulling strings all across the continent, that they are omnipotent, enormously powerful. Quite a lot of these projects that I've seen from these leaked documents are rubbish. They're kind of ridiculous. But what is the case is that these Russian political technologists are genuinely flitting from country to country ahead of elections, trying to influence, trying to kind of pick winners. And I think what's also striking is that everybody looks at America 2016, this extensive or sweeping interference election to help Donald Trump win, all of which happened. But actually, on a lesser scale, Russia's doing that everywhere, including in Africa. Sometimes it works, mostly it doesn't work, but they keep trying.
So how worried should we be about this?
I think we should be concerned insofar as, I mean, I know from my reporting in other areas that there's a huge problem with corruption in Africa. We found numerous African ministers and dictators in the Panama Papers. We found mid-level Nigerian civil servants buying £4 million houses in Kensington. There's a massive problem with corruption. And just from a transparency point of view, Russia brings opacity, it brings backhanders, it brings crooked military deals with no questions asked. And so if our starting point is the interests of African citizens, then I think we should be concerned. And actually, it's partly the fact that Russia is able to make a push for Africa in this way is partly due to a failing of the Anglo-Saxon world. The fact the Americans have got Trump, who's not really interested in foreign policy, and we're consumed by our own problems at home and seem to have lost interest in anything apart from Conservative Party politics.
Yevgeny Prigozhin didn't respond to our request for comment. He has previously denied any links to the troll factory and has said of the Wagner Group that it does not exist. Vladimir Putin has previously said that entities linked to Prigozhin do not constitute the Russian state. To read all of Luke Harding's reporting on this story and to see a graphic of the map we described, head to theguardian.com. Coming up, American comedian Jon Stewart gives a passionate speech for the heroes of 9/11. Now, for years, the American comedian and former host of The Daily Show, Jon Stewart, has fought for funded medical treatment for 9/11 first responders. Billions of dollars was released by Congress in 2015 to cover claims, but with thousands enrolled in the system, the money has quickly depleted. On Tuesday, Jon Stewart testified before the House Judiciary Committee and made this extraordinary speech.
Behind me a filled room of 9/11 first responders, and in front of me, a nearly empty Congress. Sick and dying, they brought themselves down here to speak to no one. It's shameful. It's an embarrassment to the country, and it is a stain on this institution. And you should be ashamed of yourselves for those that aren't here, but you won't be. Because accountability doesn't appear to be something that occurs in this chamber. The official FDNY response time to 9/11 was 5 seconds. 5 seconds. That's how long it took for FDNY, for NYPD, for Port Authority, for EMS to respond to an urgent need from the public. 5 seconds. Hundreds died in an instant. Thousands more poured in to continue to fight for their brothers and sisters. The breathing problem started almost immediately, and they were told they weren't sick, they were crazy. And then, as the illnesses got worse and things became more apparent, well, okay, you're sick, but it's not from the pile. And then when the science became irrefutable, okay, it's the pile. But this is a New York issue. I don't know if we have the money. And I'm sorry if I sound angry and undiplomatic, but I'm angry, and you should be too, and they're all angry as well, and they have every justification to be that way. There is not a person here, there is not an empty chair on that stage that didn't tweet out, never forget the heroes of 9/11. Never forget their bravery. Never forget what they did, what they gave to this country. Well, here they are. Certainly 9/11 first responders shouldn't have to decide whether to live or to have a place to live. And the idea that you can only give them 5 more years of the VCF because you're not quite sure what's going to happen 5 years from now, well, I can tell you, I'm pretty sure what's going to happen 5 years from now. More of these men and women are going to get sick and they are going to die. And I am awfully tired of hearing that it's a 9/11 New York issue. Al-Qaeda didn't shout death to Tribeca. They attacked America and these men and women and their response to it is what brought our country back. It's what gave a reeling nation a solid foundation to stand back upon, to remind us of why this country is great, of why this country is worth fighting for, and you are ignoring them. And you can end it tomorrow. Why this bill isn't unanimous consent and a standalone issue is beyond my comprehension. And I have yet to hear a reasonable explanation for why. It'll get stuck in some transportation bill or some appropriations bill and get sent over to the Senate, where a certain someone from the Senate will use it as a political football to get themselves maybe another new import tax on petroleum, because that's what happened to us in 2015. And we won't allow it to happen again. Thank God for people like John Field. Thank God for people like Ray Pfeiffer. Thank God for all of these people who will not let it happen. They responded in 5 seconds. They did their jobs with courage, grace, tenacity, humility. 18 years later, do yours.
Thank you.
That was John Stewart, and you can see the full speech at theguardian.com. That's all for today. My thanks to Luke Harding. And also thanks to you guys for subscribing and for all of your reviews. Keep them coming via your podcast apps. Today's programme was produced by Chika Ayres and Rachel Humphreys. Sound design is by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.